Therefore, be ye not conformed to the world. Don't let the world squeeze you into its own mold, as Phillips puts it. But I had not dealt in depth with the whole thrust of Paul's letter to the Romans for some time. And it was that recognition which led me last year to begin to look carefully at the whole epistle. And I found that in my own life a very challenging and invigorating kind of experience. I should also say, just as another point of introduction, that historically in the doing of theology, Romans has been and continues to be today a pivotal book. It was, of course, Romans that Luther turned to during the beginning of the Reformation. And since that time on, particularly in Protestant theology, consistently, Romans is the book that theologians have turned back to, have looked to, often in making new breakthroughs in theological inquiry. One of the most noted, of course, in that regard was earlier this century with Karl Barth's Epistle to the Romans. It was Barth who wrote a commentary on Romans, which literally overturned the face of modern Western theology. Similarly, even today, theologians will turn back to Romans and do a commentary on Romans to try to uncover again in a fresh way the themes of the gospel. Hans Councilman, I guess roughly the way you'd say his name, is, I noticed, just recently done a new major work on the book of Romans. So it's a book which is consistently returned to by the theological minds of the church and has, in that regard, played a very decisive role in the church's theology. Might indicate as some background some of the reasons for this. Romans is the place where Paul most consistently and thoroughly sets out his theology, his understanding of what the gospel is. It was written probably around 53 AD, and when we turn to the end of the book, in chapter 15, and if you have your Bibles with you, which I would encourage you to do during these sessions, you can follow along. We can see here some of the reasons why, or some of the circumstances which led to the writing of Romans, and I want to review these very briefly. If you look in the 15th chapter around verse 18 or 19 or so, say in 19, as a result, I have completed the preaching of the gospel from Jerusalem as far round as Illyricum. It is my ambition to bring the gospel to places where the very name of Christ has not been heard. I do not want to build on another man's foundation, but as the scripture says, they who had no news of him shall see, they who had never heard of him shall understand. That is why I have been prevented all this time from coming to you. But now I have no further scope in these parts. This is the New English translation. And I have been longing for many years to visit you on my way to Spain. For I hope to see you as I travel through and to be sent there with your support after having enjoyed your company for a while. But at the moment I am on my way to Jerusalem on an errand to God's people there. For Macedonia and Achaia have resolved to raise a common fund for the benefit of the poor among God's people at Jerusalem. They have resolved to do so, and indeed they are under an obligation to them. For if the Jewish Christians shared their spiritual treasures with the Gentiles have a clear duty to contribute to their material needs. So when I have finished this business and delivered the proceeds under my own seal, I shall set out for Spain by way of your city. And I am sure that when I arrive, I shall come to you with the full measure of the blessing of Christ. Paul is at the near the end, near the culmination of his career. He makes the rather astounding statement that he has no further work to do in these parts. By these parts he means all the way from what is Jerusalem up through what today we know as Greece. Paul is an evangelist at heart, and he says he has preached the gospel throughout all that area. independently from Paul, Italy has also received its first message of the gospel. The church exists in Rome, even though Paul had not been there. Roman tradition says that the church in Rome was founded by Peter, but that seems rather dubious. It's more likely that others first started the church in Rome. But Paul wants to go to Rome. He says in the 15th chapter, and he also makes a somewhat different explanation in the first chapter, in the first few verses of why he wants to go to Rome. There he says it's more in terms of wanting to build them up and have fellowship with them. It seems his real agenda really comes out in the 15th chapter, however. He wants to go to Rome because he thinks from Rome he can jump off and then go to Spain. Spain being a place where the gospel has not yet been preached. Thus, he finds himself at a time probably for the past 15 to 16 years when he has been working amongst the churches and working amongst the Gentiles. He's anxious to go on, but first he says he has what he describes as an errand. This is referred to other places in the New Testament. It actually is a monumental task. Paul is attempting to overcome once and for all the rift between the Jewish and Gentile Christians, the pastoral problem with which he has struggled so deeply during the past at least 3 to 4 years. You probably are familiar in general with this, the kinds of conflicts there were between those who were Jewish and became Christians and those who were Gentiles. In Galatians and in 1 and 2 Corinthians, Paul writes at great length about these pastoral issues, and more than writing, he was spending a great deal of his time trying to heal this rift. At this same period of time, for historical reasons that different commentators have speculated about, the church in Jerusalem was poor, was probably suffering from hunger, from shortage of food. And since Paul felt so deeply that there was no division between Christians, no division between, in this case, Jew and Gentile, that there was a spiritual unity, he felt that that spiritual unity had to be manifest in concrete terms, and in this case, in economic terms, so that if the Christians in Jerusalem were poor and were suffering and had a lack, that lack should be met by Gentile Christians, which at that point had more of an excess and were living in other parts of the world. Thus, what Paul says there in verses 27 and 28, 26, 27, 28, and on, he elaborates on at other points in his epistle, in his epistles. If there is a sharing of spiritual treasures from the Jews to the Gentiles, then the Gentiles have a clear duty to contribute to their material needs. Spiritual unity should breed unity in material goods as well. This is the point that Paul makes, and it was a rather, when we think of it now, a rather radical and a rather astounding point, that if in fact the church spiritually is one, then shouldn't it be one materially? This is the assumption on which Paul was working, and the reason why he had what he called this errand to do before he goes to Rome. He wanted to take this collection, which had been contributed by the Gentiles, and deliver it in person to the church in Jerusalem. And thus, in that act, make final the overcoming of the rift between those two churches. Thus it is, that's why Paul isn't going to Rome quite yet, has to do that first, but is anxious to go on to Rome so he can go to Spain and carry on his evangelistic work. It's pretty well assumed that Paul was in Corinth when he wrote this, and he was waiting for the opportunity to take his trip back to Jerusalem. And it seems that for the first time in quite a while, Paul had some leisure time on his hands. Perhaps he was waiting for a ship, perhaps he was waiting until all the collection had been received, one circumstance or another. It was clear he had some time. He was in Corinth. He had
done the pastoral work that needed to be done there, the work that we see written about in 1 and 2 Corinthians. And he had the occasion to write and reflect theologically, to set down in one fell swoop his theology of the gospel, how he really understood this all. He was writing this letter to Rome. He'd never been to Rome. Most of his other letters, several of them at least, probably most, are written to either churches which he established or churches where he had visited. And when you think about it, most of Paul's letters are really written about problems in the church. You know, I mean, they're written because there was a problem in this particular church which needed to be addressed. They're pastoral letters, meaning they're letters dealing with how does the church resolve these particular set of problems and understand the gospel deeper. Paul had never been to Rome and was thus probably more or less unfamiliar with whatever pastoral problems they might have had. There are a few allusions where he may have heard a few things. But by and large, he's writing to people whom he doesn't know, whom he hasn't met, and thus he's freer to simply write his own theology, you see, to write the things that are on his heart, to write how he understands the gospel. And it's for that reason that in Romans you have a purer and clearer and a full-fledged picture of the theology of Paul. Here's where he says it all. In the other epistles, he says it in different ways, but they're epistles that are written to specific problem situations. Romans is written pretty much with the intent of simply setting down his understanding of theology. Turn now to the first chapter. And in the sixteenth and 17th verse, you see immediately Paul announcing the theme of the letter, the theme of all he's going to be writing about. For I am not ashamed of the gospel. It is the power of God for salvation to everyone who has faith. To the Jew first, and also to the Greek. For it is the righteousness of God. For in it, the righteousness of God is revealed through faith for faith, as it is written, he who through faith is righteous shall live. 16 and 17. The central declaration of the book of Romans is found in these two verses and repeated again and again. It is about how God puts people right with himself. That's what Paul's concern is. That's what Paul is writing about. And that's what Paul calls the gospel, a term which also means the good news, the glad tidings, this declaration that a new thing has happened. The word gospel does not even appear in that form in the gospel, as we call it, of Luke. It's there as a verb a couple of times, but not in this form. It doesn't appear anywhere in the gospel of John. Appears only 13 times in Matthew and in Mark. In Paul's epistles, it's used 60 times. So Paul has taken this concept, the word, what we say gospel today, is really a term that Paul especially put into use. A new thing, a glad tiding, a good news to be declared, something that God has done, the way in which God has put people right with himself. God's power, or the meaning of the gospel, God's dunamis is really the Greek word, the word from which dynamite, our word dynamite, comes. The power of God. It is the power of God for salvation, the dunamis of God. It has taken place. It is still taking place. This is the meaning of the gospel. A fresh event has happened. It has happened totally apart from anything we have done, which also means that God does not need us. And at the outset of the gospel, at the outset of the epistle of Romans, there is that kind of humbling word. In essence, if what God has done to put us right with himself has been at God's initiative, then it follows that, as Barth says in his commentary, God really does not need us the way in which we think. You see, by that I mean God has taken the action, It rests on God's shoulders. It doesn't rest on ours. His is the initiative for our salvation. He is the one who takes the initiative in our lives. Now, upon declaring this central message, Paul then goes on to talk about what I've called the mess that we're in. And he reviews this first in terms of the Gentiles, then in terms of the Jews, and then in terms of the general ineffectiveness or impotence of the law. There are different ways of dividing up the epistle. The one which generally is used by the Interpreter's Bible and by some other commentaries, which I found helpful, is to look first at the failure of the Gentiles, which is begins right after what I read from verse 19 of the first chapter through verse 32. Now, I'm not going to read through all this. I'd encourage you to, during the week, if you come to other sessions, to read the parts that I'll say at the end of the session for the next time and reflect on them. But in general, if you think about verse 19 to 32 as being that section that deals with what Paul generally understands as the failure of the Gentiles, that the Gentiles have been given the knowledge of God but have disobeyed, and that failure, very interestingly enough, Paul characterizes chiefly as one of idolatry. It's idolatry that most typifies the way in which the Gentiles have failed to respond to what might be called the natural knowledge of God given them. Now, this is a very controversial kind of section. There are huge debates about what all this means, what is called natural theology. Those who have tried to construct strong systems of natural theology often appeal to this passage. But setting those things aside, the important point I'd want to hold up to us here is that idolatry essentially means not simply the creation of some sort of graven images which we fall down and worship. That's often the kind of sense we have. It really simply means what we worship, or more importantly, to what we belong, to whom we belong. Idolatry always signifies a sense of belonging to something other than God, of having our sense of belonging somewhere else. And thus we can begin to apply this in our own lives, in our own situations. What are the things that really claim our belonging, that claim our practical allegiance? Not just intellectual, but I mean the things that in our lives tend to claim our belonging. Do we truly belong to God as the one true God in all of our lives? Or are there other things in our society which are the idols of our society that we, in fact, are in bondage to, that we belong to? This is the kind of question that we just might hold up as we think about this particular section. In verse 32, which is at the end of this chapter, beginning with verse 29, actually, Paul tells about the consequences of what happens when people don't acknowledge don't acknowledge the sense of God that is given to them. And you can read, he goes through all the kinds of things that characterize people's lives: wickedness, evil, covetousness, malice, envy, murder, strife, deceit, malignity, gossip, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedience to parents, foolishness, heartless, faithless, ruthless. And then he says this: though they know God's decree that those who do such things deserve to die, they not only do them, but approve those who practice them. And want to hold up that last part of the verse. There is a sense here that not only is it individual transgression or an individual experience, but rather it is a sense that God's own presence or intervention seems withdrawn from the whole society, that there is a link between the individual and the corporate, which we often fail to properly understand, and that there, as Paul looks at the Gentile world, what he says is not only are people individually doing things that are wrong and that are against God's intention, but that the whole, it could be paraphrased in this way, not only are these terrible things done, but they are done with the tacit, if not expressed, approval of the whole society. Thus it is that there is evidence that God seems to have withdrawn himself from society because of the actions of the people. And I think that's a kind of sense that we also need to recover. The way in which there's a corporate dimension to disobedience that results in God's own seeming withdrawal of himself from a society so disobedient. Now we turn to the Gentile. We turn to the Jews, beginning in verse 2, in chapter 2. And in chapter 2, from verses 1 through 24, Paul talks in general and then specifically about the failure of the Jews. The first three verses speak very directly of the dangers in judgment, and presumably people speculate about the composition of those who were Christians at Rome. Most likely there were both Gentile and Jewish Christians there. But thinking of particularly the Jewish audience, after saying what a mess the Gentile world was in, he then immediately says, "Therefore you have no excuse, O man, whoever you are, when you judge another, for in passing judgment upon him you condemn yourself, because you, the judge, are doing the very same things. We know that the judgment of God rightly falls upon those who do such things. Do you suppose that when you judge those who do such things and yet do them yourself, you will escape the judgment of God?" He goes on in that vein, and in verse 13 says specifically, "For it is not the hearers of the law who are righteous before God, but the doers of the law who will be justified." Now, that particular verse has caused some problem to different commentators, because in some ways it seems to go against the heart of what a lot else of what Paul says in the epistle. The point here, however, is that those who had the law given to them, the Jews, are in no better shape than the Gentiles, because essentially all they have done is heard the law. They haven't done the law. And therefore, the people of the Jewish race are in just as bad shape. He finally makes them equal to the Gentiles, both standing under God's judgment, because simply if you hear fully what God's intention is, but if your life and if the lives of a people are still so full of disobedience and simply don't act out what has been announced and heard to you, you're in just bad shape as if you had never heard it at all. And in fact, in some cases, Paul suggests you're even in worse shape, because you really know, you know more fully how you should be acting, but nevertheless you're being disobedient. From verse 25 into the third chapter through to verse 20, Paul then talks in general about what he calls the law and how the law is incapable of saving us. This is summarized especially in chapter 3, verses 10 through 19. I want to read those because this is really the summary of this whole first section of the epistle. "As it is written, And in these passages, by the way, Paul puts together a string of quotations, mostly from the Psalms, but also one from Isaiah. So he's kind of taking several different Old Testament texts and putting them together. As it is written, none is righteous, no, not one. No one understands, no one seeks for God. All have turned aside, together they have gone wrong. No one does good, not even one. Their throat is an open grave. They use their tongues to deceive. The venom of asps is under their lips. Their mouth is full of curses and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. And just a passing comment here, consistently, one of the marks of a disobedience and a break in relationship to God is the doing of violence. This is the second time where Paul has already picked up on that theme. In their paths are ruin and misery, and the way of peace they do not know. There is no fear of God before their eyes. That ends the particular quote, and then Paul goes on to reflect. Now we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be stopped and the whole world may be held accountable to God. And in verse 24, no human being will be justified in his sight, in God's sight, by works of the law, since through the law comes knowledge of sin. That one verse perhaps best summarizes all Paul has been trying to say in the first three chapters up to this point. I want to say a little bit more about what I think Paul means by this. All of us are under the power of sin, and by sin, Paul does not mean specific acts of wrongdoing, but rather the principle and a power. We find ourselves under the power of sin. We find ourselves not simply doing sinful things, but under the power of sin. It's the state in which we live. And what is so disheartening is that there is no scheme which can save us. And we try to erect various schemes to save us. And in Paul's discussion of the law, which begins in chapter 2 and moves on into the part I just concluded with, I think what we can most understand by that is not simply the Jewish law, because Paul understood the law in a much broader term than that, but rather by the law what is meant is every human system, every human means for securing our own worthiness and our own acceptability before God. I want us to think about that. All the things that we try to do to secure our own worthiness or acceptability before God. The things we do to try to make God like us. Whatever they are. Faithful attendance at church. We go to church. Why? Because we want God to like us. Careful observance of particular moral codes. We don't do certain things. Why? Because we want God to like us, to accept us. Because in acting this way, God will approve us. We'll meet the mark. Every way we act in order to try to get God on our side. Each system or program or movement which we adopt in order to affect our standing with God and our standing with other people. Why do we join the missionary committee of the church? Because we're guilty that we haven't done enough for our Lord. And if maybe we serve on this committee, God may like us better. Why do we join the choir? Well, I'm hardly doing anything I need to do something because I'll just feel too guilty otherwise. God won't. I mean, God expects. I want God to like me. Or in another vein, why do we become involved in the peace movement? Why do we become involved in the, let's say specifically, the anti-nuclear movement? Something that I has been very close to me in a lot of my past experiences. Well, do I become engaged in that kind of witness because I want to show God that I'm worthy of being liked? I'm on God's side. If God's against the bomb, then I'm going to be against the bomb, because then I'll be on God's side, so then God will like me. Because I've got to make God like me. And I've got to do something so that God will accept me. Why do I become involved in one of the projects in the inner city in Minneapolis? Well, because I'm living a middle-class life, and I have a whole lot of the world's goods, and I feel guilty about it, and I feel God's going to judge me because I've been reading these books, and that's what they say, and I've got to do something to avoid God's judgment. So maybe I'll go down and get involved in this project, and then maybe God will like me better. All of that is living under the law. It's exactly what Paul means by living under the law, because that was exactly the situation of the Jews to which Paul, at least in part, addressed this letter.
His example seemed to say, though, that there weren't a lot of people like that he was talking about. He seemed to be talking about those who were trying to establish some, to make it possible to live the way they wanted to live. Could you just share a bit how it can also be used that way? You're talking now about a conscientious person seeking to do what God wants them to do. Sometimes we can take the law to justify, it looks like, lifestyle.
But sure. But I think that, you see, I think that some of the Jews, and Paul, of course, is very autobiographical in this, were some of the most conscientious people whom you would ever encounter. I mean, you talk about a conscientious person wanting to do it right. It's hard to find one. It's hard to find a better example of a devout, in Paul's time, of a devout Jew who was attempting to do it perfectly. Now, of course, there is also the examples of those who simply, for less laudable reasons or for self-justification, are going to use the law to their own ends. I agree with you, but I think the more difficult point that Paul is making here is that even those things which in themselves are right, good acts that God intends for the world, you see, I mean, even those things which are which we may say are the right things to do, if done for the wrong reasons, if done out of the motive of getting God to accept us, are in fact being done as though we were under the law. And I think that's the more difficult point. The predicament that we're in is that we can't do anything on our own ultimately to make God like and accept us. That comes from God. It's God's action which accepts us. It's God which takes the initiative. It's not us that become good enough or become devout enough or become pious enough so that God finally approves us. God approves us, accepts us, not because we deserve, but because God chooses to do so. Yes.
If you take those same things that you would do, like to speak out against the bomb, how do you distinguish between living under the law and a gospel-oriented response of discipleship? I mean, is it something that you have to do almost unconsciously? I mean, if you set out to say, I am going to protest nuclear arms, mm-hmm. is it ever possible to have kind of a guiltless place or a guiltless reason for doing that? Or how much do you consciously have to decide to do that, and how much is it just simply a response? How do you in your own life do that, I guess I'm asking. Mm-hmm.
Paul gets... Paul talks about these issues further on in the letter. What I want to do is, it's very interesting that both of you have asked these questions, because I think that when we hear this kind of word, and I think this is what Romans said, I think this is what Paul is saying, it's very unsettling. It's very troubling, because we want to believe, that at some levels, and sometimes at very deep levels, that the way in which the things that we do, and the particular ways in which we live can in fact ultimately affect whether God accepts us or not, that we are in charge of whether God accepts us or not. You see, I think that we still want to believe in one level or another, that whether God chooses to accept us or not is up to us. We're in control. And what Paul is saying in Romans is that, no, God is in control. It is God's initiative that accepts us. Now, I appreciate having questions, and I'm going to open up I'm going to stop saying what I'm going to say in just 1 second now, so that we have about 20 minutes to talk. I don't want us to get on to verse 21 and on to the rest until we wrestle and struggle some with this. We are all judged, and there are no exceptions. Doesn't matter what we're doing, how we're acting. We want to be right, which means we want to be the righteous one, and we are not, in spite of whatever we do. And that's the situation which, according to Paul, every person in this room is in. Wanting to be right, wanting to be righteous, yet we're not in spite of whatever we do. I thought of an example. I have a wood stove in our home in Missoula, which I'm using less and less because of air pollution problem in our valley. This spring... And it's not a very efficient wood stove, but this spring I heard a flutter inside of it and realized that there was a bird that had come down through the chimney and was trapped inside the stove. The bird was in the stove and it was just fluttering madly, trying to get out, bumping against the the sides. It had fallen down. It was obviously a little, just a little bird, young, newly born, and it was able to fly, but not very well. It had fallen down through the chimney, and now obviously was trying to fly, and couldn't do anything. Impossible to get back up the chimney, of course, but was just madly trying to get out of the fireplace. And you listen to it. And heard it. Well, finally, obviously, had to go open up the door. And immediately when I opened up the door and the light shot in, the bird, along with all the ash, came fluttering out into the living room and eventually out the door. I think Paul says we are essentially in the situation of that bird. We are in a system that try as we might, and we will try hard, we will flap our wings hard, we will bang against walls, we will do anything we can, but in fact, we can't get out of the predicament that we are in. We can't get into the light, we can't find freedom, we can't find liberation from the predicament we're in on our own. It has to come from outside of us. Someone has to come and open up a door to let light in so that we can then fly and be free. And no matter what we do, that's not going to, whatever we do isn't going to change that situation. What will change it is when God opens up a door for us and shows us light into which we can fly and be free. That, I think, is a paradigm that describes what Paul is beginning to try to say in this epistle. So now let's have more discussion.
There's a quote by Barth in his epistle to the Romans. I wasn't going to read it, but I will now. Religion is the possibility, but for this part means true faith, a true religion. Religion is the possibility of the removal of every ground of confidence except confidence in God alone. Piety is the possibility of the removal of the last traces of a firm foundation upon which we can erect a system of thought. When this possibility is realized, when our religion dissolves religion, when our piety dissolves piety, when this historical and spiritual preeminence depresses every eminence, when every confident, arrogant mouth, every mouth that thinks it can give forth even one single truth is stopped, when men as men have scaled the world's highest peaks and then discover that all the world is guilty before God, then it is that their particular advantage is established, maintained, and confirmed. Then it is that there is manifested the eternal meaning of history. Then it is that God asserts God's faithfulness and reveals that it has not been deflected by the unfaithfulness of humanity. In other words, I like keeping here the example of the peak. You know, when we do that which might be the utmost achievement in our life, climb the highest peak, and then discover that in fact we've done nothing, that all the world is guilty. It's at that point, Paul says, that our, and this is Bart's words, our particular advantage is established. It's a great advantage to know that all the world is guilty and we are a part of that. That's not a disadvantage, that's a great advantage, because that's when true faith can begin. Because that's when we recognize that all depends upon God's faithfulness, and that God has been faithful despite humanity's unfaithfulness.
This is a question I wrestle with all the time. You seem to be saying, you know, I'm going to ask a little bit of sense, ask a question. How then, you know, we can't be saved by the law. Nothing we do is going to save us. And all of our accomplishments amount to nothing. In a sense, that's what we need to know. We need to know first off that we don't know. Then, two things. How would you ever develop some kind of social or Christian social ethic out of that once you've got to that point? Because in reality, why do anything? Why move at all? Mm-hmm. Because if anything we do is not going to make any difference, why do anything? But if you feel somehow that in response to the cross, or in response to Christ, in response to God's will being fulfilled in Jesus Christ, you feel you should do something, how are you going to base that Christian social ethic?
Well, obviously, this is a central question that faces us all, and that faces Paul, and faces, obviously, those to whom the letter was addressed. Paul puts it even more sharply. He says, not just why should you do anything, but why then should you not do evil? Paul addresses that letter three times in the book of Romans, so obviously it's a question he was well aware of. I don't want to I don't want to answer it fully. I mean, I can't answer that. You know. I don't want us to, again, I don't want us to rush into the answers to those things prematurely. We've got all week. We have all our lives. But the important thing I would say, and this is a question which strikes very close to me, because my own concerns and the things I happen to feel deeply about and that I have spent most of my own life so far working on have been questions that you could term as those of a political social ethic. You know, so just indicating that this is a very serious issue. There is nothing I have said or that Paul says about not doing things like those things which we think are right, or that we're called by God. You use the words that I feel I'm supposed to do, or that I feel I want to do. You feel a response. Feeling a response to the grace of God is quite different, I think, than enlisting in a program in order to gain God's favor. You in your own phraseology, you've said something that in fact is quite different. Now, one of the problems is that I think we are so accustomed in the way the modern Western mind happens to think, and the way we've all been brought up thinking. We do something in order to get some response. You see? I mean, this is the way we're accustomed to coming at all of life. Why should I go out and protest against nuclear arms if it's not going to either stop the arms race or make God like me? All right? I need to get something for what I do. It's a foreign way of thinking biblically, very foreign, but it's the way we're accustomed to coming at problems, and thus, because we come with that baggage, we suddenly are presented with questions like the ones you've raised, very natural questions. Also questions, I should say, like our indicator, presented to people who read this letter, people with whom Paul was ministering. I don't think the epistle says, or I certainly don't think I have said anything to suggest that we shouldn't do those things we feel addressed by God to do. The issue rather is motive. The issue rather is why and how and whether we believe in the doing of those things we are in fact establishing our own righteousness. Righteousness meaning our right relationship to God, our standing before God gets changed by the doing of those things. That's what Paul is condemning and saying, if you're living that way, you're living under the law. That is different than saying, it doesn't matter how you act, it doesn't matter how you live, it doesn't matter what you do, it doesn't matter that if you feel some response, you don't need to do it. It's quite different. But hard for that to sink in. We'll be dealing a lot more with this during the week. Yes.
Is that a daily struggle for you, that some days you're doing a political or a social thing because you want God to like you, or because you want some personal glory? If you have those rare moments where you're doing it for a purer motive?
Absolutely. And I think that when...
I think the day that I thought I was doing it for a pure motive would just be the day I'm having trouble with humility.
That's exactly right. We keep jumping ahead here, but that I think of the scripture that was read last night at the Eucharist, from Romans 7. For the things I want to do, I don't do, and the things I don't want to do, I do, and we're going to talk about that later. But it's evident that there's controversy as to whether that was written before, you know, whether Paul means that before his conversion or after it. But I think all of us in this room who would read that would say, well, at least it applies to us after our conversion. And I think the answer is just as you said, this is a daily kind of struggle, because even the thinking, you see, it gets very tricky, even the thinking that my motives are finally perfectly pure, it is thus another way of trying to establish our own righteousness. Rather than our motives being pure, I think that Paul consistently talks about the response of our relationship, a relationship of our response to God's grace, to what God has done, that we live our lives in relationship to the knowledge of what God has done for us. That becomes the test that Paul constantly comes back to. Rudy?
Well, about a month ago, this is really coming out here. I joined a group of people, an entire vigil in front of the State Department in Washington, D.C., about the problem with El Salvador. And there were many old sisters and quite a number of people who took part in the group. And I actually examined my own motives. I think that I drew this book. But to me, there was a sincere effort of prayer for what was going on down there.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like that it was such a helpless thing. What could we do except stand and stop and do our presence now? People coming in and out of that building. I think again of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
That's where a man got down the other day, and he prayed during that time of prayer. He was quite a prayer. But he had to just wait for God to act to release him from it. He couldn't do it, like a bird. He was quite good with his brother. He went to find the whale. I don't know. So he was in a helpless situation too. But in his other, he finally released. And get back into the world. But in the other case, it's a matter of kind of justice, and you're asked to pray to God, then I'll petition to the Lord on something that serves the gospel. It's needed. But what I was trying to do is what we do, but at the same time, I feel like as I do it, to set myself off in the process and so on, I'm troubled by that.
I think in any, when we get down to the practical human situations of our lives, we will always find ways in which we are called to finally depend not on the purity of our motives, but on, again, on God's grace. But that's the kind of case where you're saying, whereas you examine yourself, you are there not because of a sense that by doing this God will like you better, but you are there because you understand something of God's compassion for the suffering of the people of El Salvador, and that the least one can do is to try to identify and bear witness to that in the midst of the situation we find ourselves. My own feeling is that people can be engaged in the very, you know, in exactly the same kind of activity, but be there for very different kinds of reasons and come out of very different things in their own relationship to God. And it's not a matter of ever knowing for sure the purity of one's heart, but it is. It is a matter, I think, of asking ourselves the question, what really is our basis for how we stand before God? You see, and that keeps coming back to us. I think I would be one of the last persons to discourage people from active engagement in causes of justice and peace. But I think it is For particularly those who are concerned about causes of justice and peace, I think it's very important we wrestle with what Paul is saying about the gospel, right?
Is it possible, Wes, we talk pretty much individualistically so far around the table,
And Paul is talking to Jews and Greeks, and they're still individuals. He talked about circumcision, which I don't think the Jews see in one way. I don't know. but he's still talking about Jews and Greeks as if, you know, as nations or as groups of people. That's hard for me to understand when you start talking about this.
You're right in that he refers to the kind of system of rectitude and a moral behavior that existed in the Jewish life, and refers to but yet their disobedience and their lack of their lack of responding to it. And he refers to the system, to the lack of any system, and the general moral disarray in the life of the Gentiles. He is speaking in a corporate context. There are many dangers, I think, and historically, I suppose, we can easily have witnessed them a lot. From Paul's gospel, from interpreting Romans, there are some people who take what they think is in Romans and apply it in ways which make Christianity almost wholly individualistic. There are ways in which people take what's in Romans, in response to your question up there, construct in essence a doctrine of cheap grace. Those things, I think, are things which Paul himself in his letter just attacked very directly.
Like you said, it's good news. That isn't Jimmy Smackwell. I was thinking, if you pushed America, mm-hmm. where, you know, how would you put out, what we say to us is America. We don't necessarily see ourselves as Jewish or maybe as Gentile. And is there a sense in which we Americans, the number one film, I think we've shown that, and a lot of other things around America, that could we translate what would Paul's message be to us as America? It would be good news. Would like it.
Well, I think it would be that, the good news begins with bad news, and that's what happens in Romans, that despite whatever we think of ourselves, because we live in this particular culture, which makes us believe that we are the best, that we have the most, that we are the most righteous, that in fact the particular cultural system which we have to try to assure ourselves of our righteousness, which then gets projected out on the rest of the world with all kinds of pernicious things, all of that fails to save us, because we are all judged. And we fall even more harshly under that judgment because we think that it does make us more righteous. But the good news is that, in fact, in spite of all of the vain and silly and wicked things that are done by us in the culture at large, in the name of our own righteousness, and it's hard at the root of so many, I believe, of our culture and our nation's problems is the essential sense of our own self-righteousness, that God has constructed a whole other way for people to be righteous, and it doesn't depend at all on what they do. Least of all does it depend upon what race or, God forbid, what nation they belong to. It depends, in fact, on what God has done for them. And that this gives a whole other basis of living within those nations and cultures, which set up other ways for us to be righteous. And that, I think, is what we'll get into tomorrow.